Good evening or good late afternoon to everyone. My name is Professor Chris Alden. I'm very pleased to have you join us today in a discussion of the Arctic, critical minerals, resources, and climate. This is a joint effort between the LSE Ideas and the Arctic University of Norway, Tromsø. We today are hoping to, and it's one of a series of three special focus lectures on China and the Arctic. Today's one, as I've said, looks at China's rise, its geopolitical, economic, and normative implications for the Arctic, and in particular on questions of critical minerals, environmental politics, and climate. This session is going to be chaired by our co-hosts at the University of the Arctic, Krister Prusinian. He is a professor of societal safety environment in the Arctic, at the Arctic University of Norway in Tromsø, and holds a doctorate in political science from the University of Helsinki back in 1999. And he's worked in leading management and research positions in academic institutions, think tanks, consultancies, and in intergovernmental organizations across Finland, Sweden, Russia, and Italy. His publications deal with societal security and safety, crisis management, critical infrastructure, international relations theory, foreign policy analysis, which I've worked with him on that particular issue, and regional cooperation, integration, comparative politics, political psychology, and state-society relations, and of course, Soviet and Russian history and politics. He will be leading and chairing the session. The speakers, which I will introduce at the moment, then he will carry on from there, are Dr. Sanna Kopra, who is an Academy of Finland postdoc research fellow at the Arctic Center of the University of Lapland, a visiting scholar at the Aleksanteri Institute, the University of Helsinki, and a senior research fellow at the Arctic Institute, a Washington-based think tank. She's the author of China and Great Power Responsibility for Climate Change and co-editor of China Policy and Presence in the Arctic. Following her is Professor Göran Hägglund, who is the research professor at the Fridtjof Nansen Institute. She's carried out research in China's environmental and energy and climate change policy for three decades, including China's Arctic policies. She's served as an international advisor and expert for several policy studies for the China Council for International Cooperation on Environment and Development, has an extensive experience from evaluation projects in the energy sector in China, and from 2009 and 2014 was a senior climate change advisor at the UN at UNDP China. She's lived and worked in China for 16 years and is fluent in Chinese, having studied at Peking University. Then our final speaker will be Professor Jesper William Zenthen, who's an associate professor of China Area Studies at the Aalborg University in Denmark. He holds a master's degree in Chinese from Aarhus University, Denmark, and a PhD in International Development Studies from Roskilde University, also in Denmark. In addition to the working on plans for Chinese-invested mining projects in Greenland, he's worked on Chinese land and resource politics and the bureaucratic machinations of Chinese local politics. I think you'll agree we have an outstanding panel here. And without further ado, let me hand it over to Krister. Krister.
Thank you, Chris. We are Chris and Krister co-chairing this, and we hope it will go well. Just take you a cup of coffee or tea and try to relax with these presentations and hopefully some discussions. And from my part, just greetings from the snows of Tromsø, actually. So 1 meter or so. Hopefully it goes away soon. I don't take much time. I will just give the next word to Sanna. We have Sanna, Gerilt, Jesper, that order. There is kind of a logic, kind of a from broad issues to more focused issues. We have been told by our marvelous technicians who are behind the screen here doing all the work that it's better to do it in a row, three short presentations, rather short, 15 minutes in a row, and then we will take questions and answers and discussion as much as you want. And we have 1.5 hours altogether. So we will start now. I see Dr. Sanna Kopra there, so the floor is yours, 15, max 20 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you. Hi, everybody. I suppose you can see my slides now. So my name is Sanna Kopra, and I'm going to talk about China, great power responsibility, and the Arctic. My work is based on the English school theory of international relations. It's also sometimes called international society approach, because the key concept of the English school is international society. So the basic premise of the English school is that states form an international society, which exists when a group of states consists of certain common interests and common values, form a society in the sense that they conceive themselves to be bound by a common set of rules in their relations with one another and share in the working of common institutions. And because states are member of this international society, they have some rights, some responsibilities towards the other members of international society, but especially the great powers, because from the English school perspective, power and responsibility go hand in hand. So because great powers are the most powerful players in international society, they also have certain special rights, special duties. So they should act prudently, and they have a special responsibility for the maintenance of international peace and security. And at the same time, they have a right to make decisions in regarding the international peace and security. So it's both right and responsibility that they bear. And this responsibility or right was written in the UN's charter when the UN Security Council was established in 1945. So according to UN charter, great powers have primary responsibility for the maintenance of international peace and security. China is a permanent member of UN Security Council. Of course, when the council was established, it was Republic of China that represented China in the council. But from the since the early 1970s, People's Republic of China has represented China in the UN Security Council. And from that perspective, one could argue that it can't shoulder this great power responsibility if it doesn't have access to all these forums where decisions regarding international peace and security are made. When it comes to the Arctic Council is of course not that kind of forum, because its mandate focuses on sustainable development and environmental protection, and issues of international security are excluded from the agenda of the Arctic Council. And when it comes to the UN Security Council, it has discussed climate security several times, but it has not made any formal resolution on this matter. So at present, at least, there is no international law that would regulate that great powers have some kind of special responsibility in the context of climate change. For the time being, this great power responsibility for climate change is largely a social norm, informal norm that also President Obama recognized when he was a president of the United States. The United States tried to take some great power responsibility in international climate politics, because he acknowledged that China and the United States should take the lead in international efforts to mitigate climate change because of their great power status. And almost 3 years ago, my book was published, and in this book, I argue or I developed this framework for great power responsibility for climate change. And it's based again on the English school theory of international relations. So from the English school theory perspective, we can identify two lines of ethical reasoning why we can expect great powers to shoulder special responsibility in the context of climate change. The first one is based on the pluralist ethics of English school. So it's based on the idea that great powers have this special responsibility for the maintenance of international peace and security. And climate change is a source of potential international conflict. So great powers should prevent dangerous climate change from happening and conflicts related to climate change. Taking efforts to mitigate climate change. And then the second one is based on solidarist ethics of English school. And it's based on the idea that great powers have special responsibility for the promotion of internal justice. And climate change causes severe harm to the well-being of human beings around the world. And also it's also undermines international justice. So we can expect great powers to take the lead to mitigate climate change. And in the book, I focus on China's role in international climate politics. And I argue that climate responsibility constitutes an international norm. And for China, this norm seems to be quite appealing way to define what it means to be responsible great power in the 21st century. Because in contrast to these norms related to great power responsibility that the United States has put forward, namely the responsibility to protect and humanitarian intervention, they are more or less based on norms of human rights and Western, you know, philosophies, traditions, and climate change is a more neutral, and climate responsibility is more neutral norm, and it doesn't collide with China's national interest. There are strong domestic incentives for Chinese government to take climate change very seriously, because you know the problem of air pollution is especially important in China. And it's related to burning of coal and energy politics, and therefore it's also related to climate politics. And if you don't mind, I would like to use this opportunity to advertise this forthcoming book, which is edited by Robert Balkner and Barry Busan from the LSE. It's the first ever book that will take a very in-depth look at the great power responsibility in the context of global environmental politics. And it's going to be published later end of this year or in the beginning of next year. And in my chapter in this book, I try to make a conceptual link between the English school conception of great power responsibility and the concept of international climate leadership. And I developed this concept of great climate power argue that great powers or great climate powers have this special responsibility to prevent dangerous climate change from happening. And in the chapter, I very briefly look at the role of conventional great powers in international climate negotiations. And it's made probably not very surprising that I conclude that none of these conventional great powers have played this kind of role. None of them fulfills this criteria of being great climate power. That's basically the conclusion. And when it comes to the Arctic, you probably know that China published its first Arctic strategy in January 2018. And in this strategy, it describes itself not only near Arctic states, but also responsible major country. And it doesn't make any kind of reference to its great power status or related great power responsibilities. And it, of course, doesn't mention any kind of great power rights either, because that would be probably or very likely to be perceived very threatening rhetorics by the established great Arctic great powers, namely the United States and Russia. But it mentions the role of, or its membership in the UN Security Council, and it mentions that China, because of its membership in the UN Security Council, it has these important missions for promoting peace and security in the Arctic. But the UN Security Council doesn't play basically any role in the Arctic governance for the time being. But when it comes to climate change, we can conclude that China's Arctic policy, China's Arctic strategy it's not very ambitious when it comes to climate change. It doesn't introduce any kind of new additional measures to tackle climate change on international level or regional level by reducing black carbon emissions. And it was very disappointing given the fact that when the Arctic strategy was published, China's nationally determined contribution to the UN climate regime was highly insufficient to reach the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement. You know, to limit global temperature rise well below 2 Celsius degrees above the pre-industrial levels. So one could have expected China to, shoulder or take more ambitious approach to climate change in that strategy. But it seems that China's Arctic strategy tries to legitimate China's regional role by underlining the nexus between China's domestic climate security and Arctic climate change. So it doesn't really pay attention to the fact that because of China's status as the biggest CO2 emitter in the world, it's really playing the very crucial role when it comes to the future of the Arctic. So we can conclude that even if China has sought to define climate responsibility as an attribute of great power responsibility at the global level, its Arctic strategy doesn't make any kind of reference to this special responsibility, and it doesn't demonstrate any kind of leadership when it comes to international efforts to tackle climate change. And it doesn't mention black carbon emissions, which would be also very important in the context of the Arctic. And if China would take some stronger leadership role in international climate politics, it would legitimate its role in the Arctic, and it would improve its status as a responsible great power, and it would increase trust among the Arctic states and Arctic stakeholders. And for China, which is an external actor to the region, trust is very important element when it comes to the Arctic Arctic affairs or Arctic economics, because it can't act alone, but it needs to cooperate with Arctic states and Arctic stakeholders. And if they don't trust it, it's problem. And from the English school theory perspective, we can conclude that it's not likely that China or United States would take this strong climate leadership role or shoulder a stronger great power responsibility for climate change if climate change is not securitized, because from the English school perspective, great power responsibility derives from the agenda of international security. And if climate change is not on that agenda, it's not likely that great powers would assume stronger role in climate politics. So I'll stop here, and I look forward to your comments and questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Sanna. Thank you very much. There are several issues already there that many, I suppose, would like to comment further and discuss. Let's wait for a while, and we go directly to Professor Gerrit Hegelund from Norway.
So thank you very much, and thank you to Dr. Kopra as well for putting climate and the Arctic into a bigger picture. I will continue with China and climate change and look into the question of the possibility that an Arctic dimension exists in China's climate policies. And let's see. It's working. So at FNI, we're doing research on these issues related to both the Arctic and also related to China and the energy and climate change, as was mentioned in the introduction of myself. And so this presentation will then present some of our research, current research, both on China and the Arctic, and also on the Chinese energy and climate policies. So we'll go quickly over some of the issues related to Chinese energy and climate policy domestically, and also China's interests in the Arctic. And then to the question, does an Arctic dimension in climate policy exist, and are there linkages between China's engagement in the Arctic and its domestic climate policies? And then some concluding remarks towards the end. And I think a lot of research on China and the Arctic, it focuses largely on geopolitical issues. And I think we're in this way, we are also adding something to research on China and the Arctic. So let's just dive into the presentation. And as many of you, or most of you probably know, that China is the largest emitter of greenhouse gas emissions in the world, and probably account for between 28 to 30% of all emissions. It surpassed China surpassed the US around 2006-2007 as the largest emitter of total, in total terms. Per capita, it's still, the US is still above China, although China is closing in on the European level. So, and China has had a very steep climb of CO2 emissions, increased quite quickly since 1990, almost four times, I mean 3.7 times in 2018 compared to 1990. So, and as Dr. Kopra mentioned, coal is one of the reasons, of course, for China's emissions, and currently coal accounts for about 56.8% of all energy produced or used in China. So it has been going down actually in the past 2 years, approximately maybe 1% per year is going down, but not quickly enough. So air pollution is one consequence of the coal-based economy and the particles of PM2.5, and there is quite a bit of attention placed or based on air pollution issues, and then also linking up to energy, and then also linking, of course, to climate change, because climate change in China is basically energy policy and energy issues. And climate change has become more of a concern in China than it used to be. China's national climate policy came in 2007. So from there, you could say there was a turning point in China, actually. But another aspect of China's climate change is the climate impact and adaptation issues. And this is not so much talked about outside of China, but inside China, there's a great concern of how climate impacts China's agriculture, economic impact, society, etc. China decided, or Xi Jinping announced recently, to go be carbon neutral by 2060. So we are now entering an period maybe where China will be more active in its climate efforts. So just quickly, a few words about the 14th Five-Year Plan, which was recently issued, and it does give a mixed message, as Dr. Kopra was mentioning as well, that China's climate ambitions may not be sufficient to reduce emissions sufficiently in you know, perspective of the Paris Agreement. So, and coal consumption, as mentioned, is a big challenge still, and although there are ambitions to reduce energy intensity and carbon intensity in China, it's still maybe not, I mean, there are some challenges there. And the cap on coal has not been issued yet. And we also wait for the carbon emissions action plan, which is coming. And these things may be coming in the sectoral plans that are will be published or issued now in 2021, 2022. One thing to note was that there's a 6% GDP growth set at the National People's Congress for 2021, which was only 1 year instead of for the whole five-year period. So the GDP growth is, of course, relevant to energy consumption and then emissions. So, but this is there's a lot of uncertainty around this anyway. So energy security and coal are still very important for China. Although there are some positive some nice developments as well. You have the policy of Made in China 2025, which looks into innovation in 10 core industries, which is going to be renewable energies and power sector and transport sector, I mean, electric vehicles. And as we know, that China has become a global leader on renewable energy capacity, as well as wind turbine manufacturers and solar, as well as employment, actually. So nearly 40% of the world's population, you know, in work on energy employment, renewable energy employment in China. So this is very pulling in a positive direction. Just to mention the global climate governance issue, Dr. Kopra was also touching upon it a little bit, but the US and China, they played a key role, as we know, in securing the Paris Agreement, which was, you know, in 2015. And then the US pulled out, and everybody was asking, you know, is China going to take on the leadership, which didn't really happen. I mean, China wouldn't want to do this by itself, but it turned more to the European Union in climate change collaboration and efforts. And although the EU has labeled China as a systemic rival, it still, you know, wants to work with China on climate change. And it does work, it has worked with China on many climate-related issues, such as the ETS, the emissions trading schemes, and energy, and etc. So recently, we see that the US and invited also China and other nations to the Climate Leader Summit, and Xi Jinping participated there. And there is a renewed, hopefully, collaboration between between the US and China on climate change. And we have now climate envoys such as John Kerry and Xie Zhenhua, who used to be the climate envoy for China before, and he's now back on the scene. So these are positive trends. And although there are quite a few, challenges and issues between the US and China still, but including the Arctic. I mean, US is always very suspicious about China's intentions in the Arctic. So we will just have to see how it plays out. So let's now turn to China in the Arctic. And China has an Arctic history, actually, and let's have a quick look at this history. And China signed or joined the Svalbard Treaty in 1925. At that time, it was not the People's Republic, but it was the Republic of China. And then from there, it went on to quite a few years after it set up the Polar Research Institute of China in 1989. And also a advisory committee for polar research came in 1994, and also China joined the International Arctic Science Committee in 96, and has a lot of scientific research activities from the 1990s and onwards, and organized scientific expeditions with the Xiulong, the Snow Dragon, the research vessel, since 1999. And also China established, or at least it's by the Polar Research Institute of China, set up the research station Yellow River in Ny-Ålesund at Svalbard in 2004. And a milestone for China was observer status in the Arctic Council in 2013. And then came the white paper, China's Arctic Policy, in January 2018, in which China also states it is a near Arctic state, as it is one of the continental states that are closest to the Arctic Circle. And the recent 14th five-year plan also mentions Arctic and the Polar Silk Road, but it doesn't really say a lot, but it is mentioned in the 14th five-year plan. So what is China's white paper about, very quickly? It is it lists some of China's interests in the Arctic, such as the environment, climate change, doing research, and also, of course, shipping and sea routes, energy, of course, and also fisheries, and also tourism is another interest, of course, in the Arctic. And for this presentation, we focus on environmental and climate change issues related to China's white paper. So, and if actually environmental protection and climate change stand out and really forms the backdrop for China's engagement in the Arctic, as it is stated in China's white paper. In 2017, the Arctic Polar Silk Road was proposed also as a part of the Belt and Road Initiative, the BRI. And polar research and science are ongoing, and also scientific expeditions. And research is really one of the backbones of China's Arctic engagement. So research on climatic changes, oceanography, and all those matters. And is there an Arctic dimension in climate and links to domestic climate policies? So the white paper, China's white paper, it does highlight climatic changes, and especially how it impacts on China's climate. Also, as has been mentioned before, that climate change, it's been become a very important topic for China domestically, actually, on the top of the political agenda. So this kind of makes both the Arctic and domestic issues kind of work together somehow. So there's a growing awareness of energy-related emissions and also the global impact. I think Dr. Kopra also mentioned this, that maybe China didn't really say in its white paper that it is the cause of these emissions that impact the Arctic. But I think China is pretty clear about its responsibility somehow. And that's also, you know, that's also the reason why I guess there's a lot of focus on environmental issues, or environmental and climate change and energy issues in the white paper. China's increased awareness on, as I mentioned before, on climate risk and vulnerability and resilience. China has seen changing climates in China as well, rising sea levels, droughts, and impact on agricultural production, etc. So they do see the connection to Arctic, and the sea ice melt in the Arctic also sends cold streams, for instance, towards southern China. So there is a growing awareness of the importance of the Arctic and the impact on China. And there's also has been a shift in the approach to Arctic research. I mean, there's more knowledge production, and that is relevant, highly relevant to China's own climate challenges, in particular with regard to adaptation and impact. So we do see there is a climate dimension that exists in China's engagement in the Arctic, and we links up with domestic climate challenges. And the polar research has been very important for China's climate knowledge at home, and also has been important for the other way around, also for China's Arctic agenda. So just an example of what research has been carried out in China, actually. I mean, these are national reports on climate change that are issued. This is a picture of the third national report that was launched at Paris in 2015, but they do cover all aspects of climate change in China, both the mitigation and adaptation issues, resilience, vulnerability issues, and that you see that China has experienced considerable warming in the past decades, and also, for instance, retreating glaciers in Tibet, and which is also called the third pole in China. So and also that adaptation and mitigation now kind of has, it has an equal emphasis in the different five-year plans, which it didn't used to have. So these are interesting developments in China. And actually there is a fourth national report on climate change is underway. So these reports are made, compiled by China's top scientists. And so they're quite important for China's policy making actually. So for China in the Arctic Council and scientific research, we do, as mentioned, see that it was a milestone for China to enter the Arctic Council. And the significance of this is that the work of the Arctic Council is closely linked with China's own domestic policies and priorities on environmental and climate change. So this could work both ways. I mean, it's important for China to be there and to work with other scientists in the different working groups. And also on the other side, it's important impact, could have important impact on China's actually on their own climate policies. And China has a strong climate science tradition and important in could contribute to the research of the Arctic Council. And as I mentioned, they will bring home a lot of expertise from China. So I think it has been a good thing for China to be at the table instead of being outside of the Arctic Council. It's been beneficial. So just to sum up very quickly, climate change is growing significance in domestic policy, and with the 2060 carbon neutrality goal, we will see a strengthened climate policy at home. Although there is some mixed messages, and the coal consumption is maybe increasing after all. the emissions reductions will also, if there are, I mean, their own emissions, they also impact globally. So, if they can be able to reduce emissions globally, that would also impact on a positive impact on the Arctic as well. So we will see how this works out with the US and China on cooperation in climate change. But this is back on track, possibly, but some suspicions on the Arctic, China's Arctic motives and why China wants to be so active in the Arctic. And as mentioned, lastly, the Arctic I mentioned in climate policies is definitely there. So environment and climate change stand out in China's white paper. And also, I would say that that research provides new information important for China, but also research in the Arctic also gives legitimacy to an Arctic presence for China. Just finally, a few, I don't have to go through this, but if anybody's interested in reading some of the literature, please feel free to contact me or just download. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Gerrit Hegelund, professor. We went into kind of details already here and we go further. I would like to mention that, as you probably noticed, the audience, that the questions and answers has been opened, and there are already two questions, so actually more questions within those two. So I will, my duty is then to take up as many as possible, but also the speakers, please take a look at those questions. So you feel free then when we start discussion, you can reflect to any of those. But I try to moderate a little bit so that we get it going on. So we go further now, kind of a related, but still something, at least I do not know much about the next theme, like mining, precious mining things. Professor Jesper Villain from Denmark is a specialist, I think you have been in those mines. So tell us something about that. Yeah. 15 minutes, something like that.
Yes. So now we should have a shared screen. So what I'm going to start out showing you, just a minute, as you can see, I've called the presentation actually rare earth elements as the focus, because this is one of the critical minerals we'll be looking at, and it's probably the critical mineral that has been most discussed in the context of the Arctic. So that is going to be my focus during this presentation. And I'm going to start by telling you what rare earth elements are very briefly. For a proper introduction, you should talk to a geologist. Then I'm going to look at what the position of these rare earth elements is in Chinese resource politics. And then we're going to look at this particular case of rare earth elements from Greenland and how that has played out in sort of this international relations. So that's what I'm going to, how I'm going to try to spend the rest of my 15 minutes. So to start with, I'm going to try to show you these actual rare earth elements, minerals. Of course, there's a lot of other stuff in the stone than just rare earth elements. You would need to crush the stone, you would need to do all sort of chemistry to it to get these 17 different minerals out of it, because that's why it's in the plural. It's actually 17 different minerals that are together and that you need in most of any sort of newer green technology. You can here see a picture of how many places you need different sorts of rare earth elements, which are usually found together, if you have, for instance, an electric car. So it's something you really need in the green industry. At the same time, if you want to mine rare earth elements and process them, then it's extremely dirty. So you have something that you really need in order to get a better climate, and something that is really, really very dirty to get out of the ground. So there's already a dilemma here. And in the case of many rare earth elements, they are often situated very close to at least one of the mines in uranium, the one I'm going to focus on. The rare earth elements are placed very close to uranium. So that's another issue. Another climate friendly mineral, but also a very contested mineral. So I'm going to start with this Chinese resource politics, and that comes sort of back to how why I'm interested in China, which goes very, very long time back to having Maoist teachers in primary schools in Denmark, who told me that China was this very, very huge country where nobody was starving and everybody was doing fairly well. I later learned that this was maybe not entirely true, but it has still some truth to it if you mind the jumps. One of the sort of focus areas has always been sort of resources. This is a picture from the Great Leap Forward, where one of the elements of that horrible disaster was actually trying to collect as much iron ore as possible to surpass Great Britain and become very rich in a very, very short time. That is back in the 1950s. One of the elements that you would also see in later reforms in China is actually this focus on rare earth elements. So China relatively early realized that they had a lot of rare earth elements situated in China and made a strategy for utilizing this use of it. So this is a quote you almost always hear when you hear about China and rare earth elements. It is a quote by Deng Xiaoping saying that the Middle East has oil, but China has rare earth elements. So this is sort of showing that there actually has been a way of working strategically with this very complicated technology of actually, because there are these 17 minerals and you need to get them out of the stone and you need to separate them, which is a complicated task, which has only been developed relatively lately and where China has a lot of the patents that you need. So this is one of the few cases where you can actually say that China is a leader. And going back to my discussion of why I like China to start with, I would say that China being a leader industrially of something, that should only be fair. I mean, it is a country that needs development. So it is maybe technologically leading in this particular field. And this is something that China is also very much aware of. This is a picture from Baotou, the area in Inner Mongolia where a lot of rare earth elements mines are placed. And you can see this rare earth elements stone placed next to some windmills. And in order to build windmills, you also need a lot of rare earth elements. And then it says home of the rare earth elements. And if you then go to one of the buildings where an administration of one of the rare earth elements companies is situated, you can see this beautiful sculpture of a rare earth element mineral in front of it. So it's something that plays a role. And this has sort of also resulted in China maybe not having this monopoly on actual rare earth elements resources, because if you just look at how many places you can find rare earth elements, then you can find these in many, many different places in the world. Greenland is only one of them. It has a large resource, but a very large share of the mines that are actually in operation are in China. But what China really has a monopoly on is this processing process, where China has a lot of the patents that you need to process rare earth elements once you had gotten it out of the ground. And this is something which is also a very dirty industry. So it's also something that in part maybe China has become a leader in this because they have been willing to pay the price. And China has more recently now a strategy of not only wanting to be have a monopoly on maybe processing the rare earth elements, but also to want to develop more and more of the industry that you need once that you can actually use the rare earth elements for. Then again, if you go back to this discussion of development studies, then you would say, well, this is what any developing country should do. I mean, you should try to get to do something with the resources that you have. So I don't know if this is a good or bad thing, but it's something that many countries see as a threat because this is a technology which is important for the world and where China may become an actual front runner. If we then look at international politics, then there have been a lot of discussions about how China might or might not use this monopoly on rare earth element processing. So this was mainly escalated this discussion in a dispute between China and Japan, where China wanted to stop the export of rare earth elements, and they could do this because there were export quotas on how much companies were allowed to export. It didn't actually work because many of these rare earth elements companies were owned by provinces, local governments, or private parties, so they could smuggle out the actual rare earth elements. The hope would have been that the Japanese automotive industry would have stopped, but it did not happen. But it did result in a WTO verdict launched by the US and Japan and others against China, which said that China was not allowed to have these export quotas on rare earth elements. So China has since been restructuring this rare earth element sector. It has also resulted in sort of some of the countries which have restrictions on Chinese and on state investments have stopped Chinese investments on rare earth elements. So one of these examples would be a bid to buy a processing plant in Australia in 2009, which was stopped. The way it's been managed then after this WTO verdict is that the export quotas are no longer there, but there's been a lot of more management of the rare earth element sector. So you now have a smaller number of very big companies that are state-owned that get quotas for producing rare earth elements. So now it's the environment that's sort of part of the reason for trying to regulate it. At least that's the way it's framed. So you will have to have a limit on how much you can produce, because it has to fit the need, because in the past there was actually an overproduction of rare earth elements and there was a lot of pollution. So a lot of these smaller producers have been closed or they have been bought by bigger companies, so that there are less producers and you actually have maybe more control of how much is controlled, how much is produced. And it's controlled by companies that are sort of more state-owned and easier to control. Now we turn to the case of rare earth elements mining in Greenland and how China went into this. So one of the quotes you will almost always hear here as well is this quote by Kuupik Kleist, who was a prime minister of Greenland. Greenland is part of Denmark, but it has, or had at least since 2009, it has the right to decide over subsurface resources. So it has a high degree of independence, but not its own foreign policy and security policy. And this is, of course, an issue when you're dealing with critical minerals. Are they part of security politics or are they not? So the way this has been sort of officially divided is that the part of which concerns uranium, that's Denmark's issue, and the part that concerns rare earth elements, that is Greenland's issue. So that's how that has been sort of officially divided. But when we're talking about rare earth elements, we're really talking about a mineral which is on the boundary, because the US is very much aware of China's potential monopoly of rare earth elements. And you can see sort of some of this discussion about also Greenlandic more or less independence. You would say, well, we do actually want Chinese investors. So you also had Greenlandic delegations going to China to see if you would get investors in mines. This partly has to do with it was 2009 that Greenland got its right to decide over subsurface minerals, and that was just after the Western financial crisis. So this would be the only potential investor, basically. And that was not received very well by Denmark all the time, at least. You would see people from like this Admiral Niels Wang, who said that, well, China has always had this very hard way of strategic way of thinking ahead with rare earth elements. We really need to take care. And then you had someone like Claus Hjort Frederiksen, who later became Minister of Defense, who said that Greenland might just end up as a Chinese appendix. So it was a quite harsh discussion on what to do with this China's interest in mines in Greenland. I think the most radical interpretation of this I saw was when I went to this Danish folk high school for elderly people, where it was sort of presented that these people that you see on the picture, who are people that have been invited by the fishing company Royal Greenland to work in Greenland and are from China, that they are really the fifth column of the time of the Communist Party. So it is really also being sort of this idea about China being dangerous is also sort of harming Chinese citizen, you can say. But if you then look at the actual places where you have had Chinese investments, they, of sort of Chinese investment plans, they cover a very large share of the potential projects that have been talked about in Greenland. So you have some airport projects, you have the Isua iron mine, that also was a naval base that the Danish Ministry of Defense wanted to sell. Then there's the Kvanefjeld project, which is what I have been talking about, this rare earth elements project. And then I haven't got that on the map. We also have a potential mine in Eastern Greenland. And all of these projects have had not necessarily controlling, but considerable Chinese investment plans. This doesn't mean that have been actual Chinese investments. So we can try to look at the different plans that there have been. That these were sort of the plans that were early in the stage. You would have a number of different state-owned companies that were interested in exploring mines. And it's very normal that you will have a lot more companies wanting to explore mines than you will actually have developing them. but these companies were interested to start with. They were later, one of the projects was given up, another one was taken over by another Chinese company, the interest. Then you had this General Nice group actually wanting to buy this naval base, which then was all of a sudden no longer for sale from the Danish Ministry of Defense. Then you had a Chinese company wanting to buy the Skvanefjeld project with the rare earth elements mine. And the iron mine, that didn't really work out. Iron prices got too low. Then you had this China Communications Construction Company Limited that wanted to give a bid on building airports in Greenland. Then all of a sudden that Danish prime minister went to Greenland and said, by the way, you can borrow the money very cheaply from us. So that was also stopped. And then also all of a sudden in this Northeastern Greenlandic project, which was where you had a Chinese company involved for a very long time, then the Export and Import Bank of the US, the US policy bank stepped in and said that they would finance it. And now there's no talking about Chinese investors. So there is not much Chinese interest left in Greenland right now. When I talk to those Chinese people who actually know something about the Chinese interests, who are connected to them, then I also hear that, well, we don't really have new investment plans in China. In Greenland, it's simply too sensitive. But this Shenghe company kept on for quite a bit of time, and it was maybe particularly well suited for doing this because it's sort of both a private company that you can invest in, buy private stocks. At the same time, it's founded by a subdivision of China's Geological Survey, but it doesn't own. It owns considerably less than 20%, which means that when you want to invest in Australia, which it did to buy this. Buy itself into this Skvanefjeld project, it needed to buy a share in a company in Australia. And they have rules. If you have more than 20% of state ownership, then you can't do that if you're Chinese. But it could easily buy this, and it has even bought the biggest US rare earth elements mine because it's not a state-owned company. But it's still sort of state-controlled. It means it has the right connections to the Chinese state authorities. So it has these different ways of dealing with things. You can also say it has an incentive to actually speculate in mining outside of China, because it's not one of the big companies that should get a lot of production quotas. So getting a production chain outside of China would be a benefit. It's highly specialized in rare earth elements, but it doesn't maybe have access to quite as many production quotas. So there are many reasons for this company to want to go out. Some of them could be sort of very state controlled. Some of them could simply be circumpassing what the state wanted, namely that wanted it not to produce that many rare earth elements. We don't know. And what happened then in 2021 was that there was this recent Greenlandic election where the party that doesn't want uranium mines in Greenlandic ground won. So now the project is stopped. So there are currently no big Chinese investment potentials in Greenland. There may be in the future, but actually now there are none left. And the result of this has been that, well, the stock prices for Greenland Minerals and Energy, the company, the Australian company, which the Chinese company had bought part of, they have of course fallen a lot, and it's close to worthless now because the plants are not there. Whereas the discussion about the Shenghe company, the Chinese company that bought a share in the mine and also spent some money of this, is, well, is this news about the Greenlandic election, is that good or bad for Shenghe? And then that is maybe a good question, because the Chinese interest in getting into Greenland, it could be twofold. It could be that you want to actually get the rare earth elements. It could also be that you wanted to control whether or not a mine is actually going to produce rare earth elements outside of China. And if that is the case, then it has been achieved. It's not going to be produced. And it hence doesn't harm the Chinese monopoly. We don't know what happened, but this is sort of the situation right now. Yeah, that would be it.
Thank you, Jesper. It was very interesting, and the conclusion was quite interesting as well. So it might be about interpretation and closer knowledge about these issues, how things are. We have around half an hour time now. I have identified five people in Q&A who have one or two questions each, and some of them might be packed together. But I think I try to do that to save overlap and take too much time. All of the speakers can, of course, pick up their own questions there. I would like to start, and you can comment also on on each other's presentations. So we will have two more of these type of webinars, and one of them will be dedicated about security issues. But you cannot deal with this with China in the Arctic without having that element. And we have at least three questions which include that element. And let's try to take it rather shortly, because we have anyway we have it in one of the future webinars as a main theme. But Pavel Diviatkin from the Arctic Institute looked at what are the military actions of China and aspirations related to all this that has been discussed today in the Arctic. And Ulle Kauert from Maastricht University also asked that how all this fits to China's master plan or something, if I understood it correctly. So all this climate change policy, but also what Jesper talked about, this rare earth elements. And then in a way, quite interesting theoretical issue also directed literally to Sanna Kopra, Dr. Sanna Kopra, was that that could you give us kind of a example about what is the difference between great power having a responsibility or whether it has an interest. So anyone could start. Perhaps we start with Sanna, because you were the first speaker and you haven't been speaking.
Okay, now. Thank you, Rasmus, for the question. It's a very tough question. And I'm not I'm not the right person to answer it, because I've only focused on the in international climate politics, and I'm not familiar with the English school literature on for example, security and humanitarian intervention research. But generally speaking, probably there are no such examples, because of course, if you think that the great power responsibility is about the maintenance of peace and security in world, it's of interest to themselves also to quite often to have a stable international system. So in that sense, we can probably just say that interest and responsibility seems to be a kind of two coins of one coin sometimes, and especially if you think that responsibility is something that requires sacrifications, then it's very difficult to give any examples. I can't think of any examples. And usually the English school scholars mention that the Soviet Union and United States were able to cooperate during the Cold War on arms control, because it was important for the maintenance of international peace and security, but it's also very difficult to say that that was not related to their own interests either. So I don't know if that's a very good example either.
Thank you, Sanna, and thank you for, I forgot to mention Rasmus Pertesen from UIT was that question about responsibility versus interest. And we can continue to this issue from Ole Kauert and Pavel Diviatkin about this master plan or as main aspirations. If Dr. Kopra used this coin thing, so what is kind of the currency of this this coin then? What are the real aspirations? Any comments on this? This from the others, like Professor Zeuthen or Professor Hegelund. Any of you? Let's start with Professor Hegelund. So you have any comments?
Sorry, which question did you ask?
It was I combined because they are basically the same. That one and two questions, one and two. So there was a question about this. Basic military actions, aspirations in the field, and then in the second question there was about this, that how this is all related to China's plan. So, do you see any plan of China, and how does your presentation on climate change issues are related to this plan?
Well, so far I don't think we have seen any evidence of any Chinese military activity in the Arctic. I mean, there has been no activity to my knowledge. And what do we know about aspirations? I mean, in the future, I mean, some think that China could have some aspirations in the future, perhaps. And this is probably also why maybe the US and Pompeo at, 2019, that he spoke about China and the Arctic. And I think, to my knowledge and to my understanding of China's strategy and policy in the Arctic, I don't see that coming. Yeah.
All right. And Jesper would like to continue about that. And also there's a kind of a related issue. Two related issues in these questions. One is about that how does EU then fit into this issue or question, because EU is kind of on the sidelines, not being integrated into.
I would like to start with the first one. I agree with Professor Gerl that there is very limited evidence that there should be any military aspirations. There have been some plans maybe of sort of, I mean, or there are plans of supporting satellite systems and other sort of infrastructure, but that is not sort of military in that sense. I mean, it's about communication and stuff like this. And then there was this question about the moon launch, I think I saw, which I'm going to address in this, because I think very much you could say that the Arctic is also, I don't think there's any connection to resources and the moon, but I think there's to the Arctic and the moon. I mean, it is also an adventure for China to be able to show that it is actually a great power and is able to capable of being present in the Arctic. I think is sort of a similar activity, sometimes at least. And then to the EU. I mean, the reason why the EU is not a member is because it's not a state, whereas China is a state. So that's why it's not in the Arctic Council and China is. I'm not sure there are that many possibilities for direct EU and China cooperation in the Arctic, but that is sort of more a general thing that China would like to have bilateral cooperation, if possible. But the EU is cooperating on sort of addressing some of these issues that could become sort of security issues for the EU members of the Arctic. So that there are plans of making strategies for instance, critical minerals in the EU and they are very much there to address the way that China works with critical minerals. So it's a reaction, you could say, to that. It's not cooperation, but it's a reaction to what's happening. And it's the EU that governs that process.
Thank you very much, Jesper, for that. And everyone who has put some questions there, so I try to cover all. I have a rather good picture about that. And also Professor Alden's question, which comes through another channel here. So I try to do that. There was an interest in the difference between Arctic versus Antarctic in terms of that. Is the international regime related to Antarctic region kind of a tighter that there's not so much room for maneuver for China or any other than compared to the Arctic? Can do anyone have any picture about this kind of comparison between Arctic and the Antarctic, the polar regions?
Well, maybe I didn't really study that much of Antarctica and China, but of course China was involved in the Antarctica earlier than the Arctic, and it seems they have like four research stations in Antarctica, while they have and a fifth coming, I think, in 2022. And it seems, from at least from what we have studied or seen, that Antarctica seems to be higher up on the political agenda for China than the Arctic, actually. And I think this is something also links up with the question on the military, and you know, how important is the Arctic for China, actually. I mean, it wants to be at the table, of course, but and it is increasingly important somehow because of the geopolitical attention that China or the Arctic is getting now by the US, and you know, also, so I mean, taking all these, you know, the big politics into account, of course, you know, in China's foreign policy picture, I don't think the Arctic is the biggest, you know, the most important place. I mean, yeah, part of its, but then Antarctica might be a little bit more important in its foreign policy and Arctic research and operations engagement. That's our impression, at least from speaking with them and reading some things. But as I said, I mean, I didn't do a very close study of Antarctica and China's activities there.
Thank you very much, and there are new questions coming up. Let's take Anne Nyheims. She is a journalist. I think directly to Jesper's issue that you discussed it a little bit, but just to make it clear that. How much of the rare earth elements resources are in China, and how much in the Arctic?
Mm. It depends on how you define resources, because if it's really things that you could potentially at some point pick up, then there are really a lot in China, but there are really a lot in many other parts of the world, including the Arctic. But the problem is that it takes time to develop a mine. And you need a plan, and you need finances for it. So the thing is that if supplies from China stop from one day to another, then the world has an issue, because then you don't really have access to these resources. It would require developing a new mine, which takes time. So that's the main issue. The rare earth elements are not that rare.
Thank you very much. I think that the next one in the row. In the line would then be Chris Alden. It was about biodiversity. You can put your question perhaps by yourself, because you are here.
Okay. That would be great. I just wanted to ask, when we were speaking of resources, when people talk about the environment, of course, they're focusing on biodiversity as well. And I'm wondering, especially when it comes to marine biodiversity, but can be terrestrial as well, if there's something in the in China's policy in the environmental approach which has a positive, negative. And what I have in mind, of course, is the fisheries area in other parts of the world, but I just don't know, so I'm interested if anyone can comment on China's policies when it comes to this particular area of biodiversity.
Okay, anyone?
I forgot to unmute myself. Yeah, it's a good question. Although, as I mentioned in my presentation, is that the environment, of course, is the starting point and the foundation, of course, for China's engagement in the Arctic and the interest and the, and you know, protect the environment in the Arctic. And I think this is quite high on China's, at least domestic agenda. It's very high because, you know, China is hosting the Biodiversity Convention COP15 in Kunming this year in October. So biodiversity has become, you know, quite an issue in China, and also linked up with the COVID and the wildlife, you know, and the environmental laws that are being changed because of COVID-19. And you know, so I think, your question is interesting. And so far, I think there's not, I mean, with regard to resources like fisheries, I think this is early days still in the Arctic. You don't really know about, you know, the fisheries yet, I think. But I think China is a signatory to this agreement, or the fisheries agreement that was, I think, was it a couple of years ago. So it is involved in, you know, protection of fisheries and the seas. And it should be on the agenda, yes. But China is, it is an observer state of the Arctic Council, for instance. So, I mean, it has possibility, you know, to participate in the different the working groups of the Arctic Council. And within those groups, I think, you know, it's a possibility for China to, you know, to provide research or learn from results, you know, in these working groups. Black carbon was mentioned before, and I think China didn't submit a report on black carbon to the Arctic Council, but I know that bilateral cooperation with China on black carbon. So, I mean, things are happening, maybe not always through the Arctic Council, but through bilateral channels as well.
I would say that in the case of Greenland, at least, then most of the Chinese investment was stopped because they were Chinese, but not the one on rare earth elements. It was stopped because of biodiversity. So it does play a role.
It was not decided by China. Huh? It was decided.
It's decided by Greenland, but it was the concern for biodiversity that stopped it, not the concern about not wanting China to enter.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
that's good. Okay, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. There are still a couple of questions coming up, and we have 10 minutes time, so let's try to use at least 5 minutes to this, and then perhaps close with some words from Chris. There is, let's take it in this order that I have them here. There's Kamna Tiwari is asking about that, whether this actually China's Belt and Road Initiative is against any climate change limitation reduction goals, because it adds to energy usage and infrastructure. So isn't it, there is a fundamental kind of a contradiction between this big project of Belt and Road Initiative and climate change goals.
Yes, that's true. A lion's share of the Belt and Road Initiative's project focus on fossil fuels, even in countries that haven't burned coal or oil, used oil before. I mean, developing countries in Africa, for example. So it's a really important issue. And even if China is now seeking to become carbon neutral by 2060, but at the same time, the project related to Belt and Road Initiative continue to invest in fossil fuels. It's quite contradictory. And we studied with my colleague Matti Nojonen, we studied what kind of environmental norms we can find from the documents, Belt and Road documents, and I mean related to environmental responsibility, and there are not many. I mean, they have mentioned that they pursue for green development and things like that, but in the end, these there are no very well no ambitious goals or any environmental standards that would be followed in those projects. So at the moment, it seems that the environmental aspects of Belt and Road initiatives are very harmful for the nature.
Okay, now we know that. Next in the row is a question from Mr. Grant. It's related to question of Pavel Diviatkin, who was asking about this scientific cooperation, which was already a little bit discussed in one of the presentation quite in detail. So that those satellite stations that China has been planning, I don't think that they managed to do it neither in Sweden or in Finland, but I'm not quite sure. So whether they have a quite direct military role to play. Anyone knows anything about those satellite stations that have been planned and criticized and not established and so on?
Yeah, in Finland, they haven't established their own satellites, but in Kiruna in Sweden, they established the satellite ground station in 2016. And Swedish Defense Agency warned about potential dual use of this satellite. They could use that information for military purposes, in the future at least. But I'm not sure what is the status of that satellite station at the moment, because Sweden has decreased satellite cooperation with China. So I don't know what is the contemporary situation with that ground station.
Yeah, there is a Rasmus comment that Swedish Space Corporation will not renew contracts for Kiruna. So that seems to be again kind of a bad news for China. So that the plans are not finalized. Then we have a question from William Wang from UIT. It goes that in Greenland, as an alternative to resisting Chinese investment, how acceptable is US funding in Greenland? Well, at least they didn't sell Greenland to US, but okay. So what is Jesper perhaps knows about that?
I would say that from Denmark at least, the US funding is much, much more acceptable. From the point of Greenland, I mean, what you would hear the government say is that they really just want investment. So it doesn't matter so much where it comes from, but it's not particularly close to US investment. And there have also been concerns about some of the Chinese investments, to be honest, but also to the US investments. But the problem is that there are very few investments materializing. So for all of these projects we saw on the map, which would each be more than the annual GDP of Greenland, it is really only the airports that will be built, and they will be built for Danish money with partly US funding, and then there may be the mine in northeastern Greenland. So there is a need for investment in general, and that's the main concern. And then I can see Rasmus had a correction to what I said about the EU, and I think that is very correct what he said, that the reason for EU not being an observer in the Arctic Council is because of their view on seal, and because the Canada has a seal ban, and apparently, so I was wrong about that. Sorry.
Okay, thank you, Jesper. I think now is the moment that I will thank Professor Gerrit Hegelund. I will thank you, Dr. Sanna Kopra and Professor Jesper Zouten. Very interesting indeed. And we will come back to these issues. You see that it's multidimensional issue, and there are a lot of kind of issues that when both brought together, so they become very complicated suddenly. And we perhaps need more multidimensional interdisciplinary cooperation in this field in research. So I will give this back. I thank you for my part, and I will give this back to Professor Chris Alden. Thank you.
Thank you very much. First, thank you, Krister, for a steadying hand as throughout the chairing of this, and your input as well. And of course, thank you very much to all the colleagues who've presented, given us the benefit of their background knowledge and expertise. It's really helped us to untangle the story a little bit. It's also set the stage for our next talk. We kept skirting that the G word there, geopolitics. Well, I think we'll try to take it head on next time in October, when our next meeting the date to be confirmed on this series on the Arctic and China will take place. It remains for me to thank again the University of the Arctic, our collaborators at Tromsø, and in the name of China Foresight, LSE Ideas, which sponsors this event on our side. Thank you very much. We're very glad to have had such a wonderful turnout, and we look forward to seeing you in October.